This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
You know, football's a tough game, you know, and you have to find that right balance between attacking and defending. At the moment, we seem to have it very well. You know, we've scored some good goals, but probably more pleasing for me is the will to keep the ball out of the back of the net, and you know, the desire from the whole team to get back and defend when we lost it. And you know, it's keeping that balance. You know, and if you've got that, then you've got a chance of winning football games.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now. So I'll play it for you. It's called "My Old Man."
Try and win it back. McGinn early through, and Jack Grealish is there and scores. It's a disastrous start for Fulham. A goal down inside 4 minutes, and Jack Grealish has his first Premier League goal of the season.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast, the Thomas Muller of Aston Villa podcasts. Joining me for more discussion on this marvellous, unbeatable team, Mr. Chris Budd.
Hello.
And welcome again to Mr. Phil Shaw.
Hello.
We're all in a bit of a state of shock in Match Club. Aside from beating Fulham 3-0, we're in this weird position where we have a long unbeaten run that stretches back through cups, through friendlies, through seasons. It, you know, it laps over two seasons now. And we're also, we haven't conceded a goal in the league in our two games so far. We are 100% in the league as well. And we're also in the top four of the league, despite our belated start to the season. And playing one less game than a lot of teams. Where do we start, Mr. Bird? It's almost like we're having to throw the rule book away of how to deal with Villa games and start a new one.
I know, we can't. We've got nothing to be cynical about. What the hell is going on?
Not that we set up to be cynical.
But it's great. It's great. You know, we're playing good football. There seems like there's a real positive momentum in the fan base and in the team. And you know, you're seeing a team that have, dare I say, been knocked into shape a little bit, which is great. You know, it's taken them a long time to do it, but it's good.
Phil Shaw's always been a connoisseur of slick football. How does what you saw against Fulham level up to that? On a range of 1 to 10?
On the slickometer.
On the slickometer, how far are we up the slickometer at the moment?
Ooh, don't want to get too carried away. I mean, it's a 7 sliding into an 8, but it's good.
I'll take that. I'll take 7 into 8. That's you know, there's always room for improvement then.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll get into Villa's situation and the last two games since last we spoke. A glorious cup win. I mean, that was 8 on the slickometer, the way we disposed of Bristol.
Oh, the Traore goal was a 10 on the slickometer.
Because I thought that was going to be a bit of a sticky wicket, that game, especially when I saw the team sheet. But anyway, we'll talk about that later on. Coming up before, we'll go through what's been happening in Villa news. Also, 3 points. Again, we will quickly brush on the continue situation of football, well, pretty much football below the Premier League, in light of the increasing seriousness of the COVID situation. Also, we'll quickly talk about this handball situation, which I thought might have popped up in the Fulham game, but we've managed to go another 90 minutes without handball controversy, which seems to be plaguing every other game. And also, we will have a look at what Mr. Gareth Barry is currently up to as well. Coming up at the end of the show, in underrated and overrated, or overrated, we look at Mr. Neil Cox and his peculiar story. And also the, I don't know how to describe Richard Dunn, polarizing.
Yeah.
He's his nickname, the Dunny Monster.
Oh yeah, the Honey Monster, the Dunny Monster, yeah.
See, if he was down in Australia, that would have a totally different meaning, wouldn't it?
Anyway, we will talk about his time and we will accordingly rate them. Right, first of all, the Villa news. Ali Samatta left for Fenerbahce. I thought somebody would have come in before he went, but we're certainly in the position now of where we were last season, where Smith was saying, oh no, I'm happy with my options, and he's already suggesting Traore can play down the middle as well, which he can, and we all knew that, but it's like, yeah, I wouldn't be saying it just yet. I would be trying to get in another striker, which I think he, well, we'll come on to that. But the funniest thing about Ali Samatta leaving was the Tanzanians weren't too happy, or they proved their plasticness, because I think Villa started off the day with 916,000 plus Instagram followers, and since he's gone off to Turkey, they've lost 44,000 Instagram followers.
Yeah, there's been an Insta exodus, hasn't there?
Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, I've written an article about this in Venglos View and joked about Villa having to give Elmo and Trezeguet 10-year contracts with double the pay of Jack Grealish just to
keep the Instagram numbers up.
Just to keep the whole social media numbers up, because that'd be like a black hole, because you're looking at somebody like Trezeguet, who's got, I think, 4.6 million. And anybody who follows the Aston Villa Facebook page will know about our Egyptian friends and their worship of our favourite sons, as they like to call.
Meanwhile, Ollie Watkins has only got 52,000. You're thinking, he's a marquee signing, man. We're going to need bigger engagement than that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't believe they put, is it 28 million on somebody who's only got 50, or, and he didn't have that many when he signed. Trezeguet, I can't believe they got him a chump change for Trezeguet, when normally a player with that social media following would be like, you know, 100 million or something. Anyway, watch out. It's kind of interesting, though. The Egyptian boys have got like massive followings, bigger than the club across some, well, Trezeguet trumps the club in every aspect. And we forget about that. Grealish is, I think on Instagram, about 900,000. So he's not even a fourth of the man that Trezeguet is.
I'm sure we'll find out whenever Jack hits a million. Somebody will tell us.
I'm sure they will.
Surely not.
Anyway, moving on. As I alluded to, Smith said in the press conference before Fulham, openly said the one more body in was more than likely, a striker. And they were also suggesting they were trying to hustle in a midfielder. Maybe it was the Loftus-Cheek from Chelsea loan deal that's been mentioned. I mean, the Ross Barkley thing seems so unlikely, considering his wages, and also he's in matchday squads and Chelsea are playing on, you know, several fronts. Oh, hi Ross. What are you doing here? Season-long loan? Cool. Welcome to the Villa. Also out the last week, the third kit has finally come out, which had most people thinking it's some kind of camouflage number, but it turned out to be a map of the regions of Birmingham. I haven't had a chance to see if my region's in there. Are you represented, Mr. Bird?
Not that I could see, but I don't mind that. Another kit that I'll add to the list of kits I won't be buying.
Well, you're just a killjoy.
I think it's all right, actually, for a third kit.
Yeah.
It actually looked quite good on the pitch.
Yeah, it did, actually. I mean, that's the thing. I think the third kit, you should go for it.
Yeah. And the shorts are a bit rascal, though, to be fair.
You kind of hold back your criticism if they really go for it. It's, you know.
Last season's third kit was better, though, I would say. I did like the green and red one. I thought that was a good statement kit.
Well, other people don't like it. Other people prefer this. I mean, it's all subjective. at the end of the day, I'm not going to lose too much sleep over kit designs. But no, I think it's been taken up pretty well, though. But we needed a lighter kit, to be honest, when we played teams in red, mm-hmm. because the black and obviously the claret, you need some bit of contrast, especially for those people in Northern Ireland with their black and white TVs as well. Isn't that right, Phil?
Yes, I mean, that's why we have so many good snooker players.
God bless Alex Higgins. He was one of my childhood, probably not the greatest childhood hero to have, but considering he was always holding a pint and chain smoking cigarettes, but never mind.
It's just like the rest of us over here. I don't know what you mean.
Anyway, also in the news, another young player is signed from Feyenoord, Lammer Bogard. I think he's 16, isn't he? So there's been a few ins around the kind of 16-year-old age.
Yeah, they've gone in a pretty aggressive strategy on that front. They're really obviously trying to overhaul the academy system, and hopefully that'll bear fruit in, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah, it's an interesting age to get players, especially if you're playing big money, because there's no real guarantees at that age that A, they might stick with it, but B, also, you know, there's evolution, you know, there's still growth to kick in, so you don't know if you get, you know, what the final player will look like physically in terms of height and, you know, size, etc. Mm-hmm. It's like a development situation. What do you think they do? Do they get DNA samples and they check their genes and stuff to see what the end product's going to be like?
Well, they just need to look at his uncle Winston Bogard.
Was he spent, like, was it 4 years on the bench at Chelsea and made about £9 million for never playing? Rumour has it he used to commute to training from Holland because he only used to train 3 times a week with the reserves.
Where is he now?
No idea.
Right, let's get into the 3 points. We've spoken about this a lot because obviously it's a big issue this week. There's been a letter signed off by various people from the EFL, FA, Football Supporters Association, warning the government about the potential collapse of the National League structure, you know, even EFL clubs in the lower couple of divisions, and how the face of football is in serious danger of completely changing. Obviously, there's no chance of supporters returning to football anytime soon, so gate receipts that the lower league clubs and grassroots clubs rely on are at the moment on ice, so this is going to cause serious problems. And there's kind of a twin conversation here. One is for the Premier League to drip some more money down, and also for the government to do a bit of a handout for the lower echelons of the football league. So we'll see rather than discuss it now, we'll see what happens later on this week, and it'll probably be a point for discussion for the next podcast. Number two, it's kind of blown up this weekend, the whole handball situation, which was in the 3 points when we alerted you that there would be a change this season. The idea of these rule tweaks are to make it clean cut and dry, but I mean, you could pick many examples. There have been so many handballs over the opening of this season, which is you know, barely 2 or 3 games deep. But you know, the Eric Dier example in the Spurs versus Newcastle game, where the ball hits him on the back of the arm, he's not even facing the way the ball's coming to him, and that's given as a penalty, and he knew nothing about it. But the letter of the law says accidental. It doesn't matter, does it, if it's below a certain line? And
that
its body shape is not normal, and then the other 2 or 3 things it has to fit in. But that wasn't a penalty, surely. I mean, obviously Mourinho was not happy about that.
I mean, to be fair to him, you know, Bruce came out after the game and said, you know, we're going to get these decisions go forward against us through the season. So while we got away with one today, I completely accept that it's a woeful rule and a crap decision.
Yeah.
Especially when the referee's gone and had a look at it on the monitor and hasn't actually shown any common sense. But of course, by the letter of the law, he has to give it.
Yeah, as if there wasn't enough things about watching Villa that give me anxiety, there's now this foreboding handball rule that's come in. I just sit now watching games waiting for the one time that it flicks up and hits Mings or flicks up and hits Konza. I mean, my wife, she played hockey at, you know, a reasonable standard, and she says it's just the hockey rule. I mean, she says the longer she played, they actually stopped going for goal whenever they got near the net and just tried to flick it off, you know, hockey players' feet to get a penalty corner. You're going to get footballers doing that now, just going into the box and just looking at it hands and things like that. I mean, you already saw that the Newcastle team were well drilled and appealing every time Carroll got a flick that sort of hit a body of a Spurs player.
Yeah, and Spurs, I think Match of the Day did a kind of an analysis of this where they all had their arms behind their back almost pretty much every time Newcastle approached the 18-yard box. They also put up some stats. I think last season, in the first 3 weeks, there was 8 penalties awarded in 30 games in that period, and none were for handball. And we've had 26 games in the first... This is before Villa played. There was 20 penalties awarded in 26 games compared to 8 in 30. And 6 of those were for handball. So you can see the difference straight away. And, you know, last season, just to give you some context, because these rules... I think it's FIFA are behind this, aren't they? Because they're trying to make it uniform across the whole world. And last season, before the Premier League was pulled in line with this FIFA orchestrated rule, there was 19 handball penalties last season, while in La Liga and Serie A, La Liga 48 and Serie A 57. So there's a massive difference. So it's going to, I think they're trying to make it more exciting so there's more goals as well, but you just get more bitterness and more pissed off players, managers and supporters, I think.
It pisses everyone off because everyone thinks it's a farce.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that goes. But hopefully, as Phil says, you just hope that Villa aren't victims of it. Point number 3, Mr. Gareth Barry, once of Aston Villa for almost, well, for a decade, is now playing club cricket in his retirement. Chris Budd, you know more about cricket.
I do. Yeah, so Mr. Barry obviously retired this summer. and clearly didn't want to go into, you know, he's been quite open about the fact that he doesn't want to go into management or coaching right now. I think he just wants a break from the game, even though I think he sort of came out and said that he misses the training ground atmosphere more than the games and trying to physically get through the games and stuff. So basically he's gone back to his village where he lives called Temple Grafton and has started back playing cricket for the first time since he was young. So he's been going in at number 5 and he's a first change bowler. So currently this summer he has a top score of 83 not out. So he's clearly
What's the level here? I mean, are we talking a proper serious level or is this just like hobbyist?
No, it's the Cotswolds Hills Cricket League. So it'll be kind of okay. I'd imagine it's a very twee league. It's not going to be like a county, you know, clubs level like a Birmingham League or a Yorkshire League, but it'll be an okay standard of village cricket.
Right. Well, we wish him all the best in
his new endeavours. Nice part of the world to be, though, isn't it? Pissing around playing cricket in Temple Grafton. Very nice.
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather be doing that than, like, let's say, coaching at West Brom or something like that.
Or having to work your way up from the lower leagues.
Yeah. Before we move on, I just want to say a big thank you, as per usual, to all the My Old Man Said patrons. Thank you very much for supporting the show, signing up since we last announced them. Thank you very much to Peter Consagra, Russ Jukes. Welcome back to Mr. David Waldron. Thanks to... And he calls himself Beef Fried Rice. We'll go with that. I didn't know if that was a reference to anything we've done, but we'll live and learn. David, without surname, David Schilling, Frank Varty, Chris Lee, Corbin Conover, David Grimmett, Chris Parker, Russell Brandreth, and Ben Borton White. Right, thank you for signing up. My Old Man Said patrons get access to extra shows and also entrance to Match Club, which we are running every game Villa play at the moment. It's our little secret members club. So if you want to get access to that, do support the show and sign up as a patron. Thank you very much. You can also, if you pay for an annual subscription and save 15%, which is roughly 2 months. So go to the myoldmansaid.com website and click on the Patreon link for more details there. Thank you very much. Right, on to the main discussion, which it's pretty much around Villa's early form and how things are going. It's a bit too early to read too much into things since we've played 2 cup games and had to, let's say, I mean, we played 10 men, Sheffield United, so you can chalk that off as a opportunity, shall we say. And Fulham, we went there, I think most of us went there confident that they weren't looking so hot, while we seemed to be a bit more resolute and potentially that this was a great chance to register 3 points away, which last season was a bit of a rarity. So we beat them 3-0. What do you put that down to, Chris? Chris. I think the two early goals sparked the fire, but it was the way we scored them was the most pleasing thing. And I think that kind of gave everybody a spring in their step.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that to start so quickly, I think generally we've seen with Villa, if they start well, especially since the restart period after COVID, if we started well, we generally could push on. Which when we get that confidence, and I think, you know, the second
Grealish's
goal,
fourth minute, was it not?
Yeah, something like that. Scoring the first 5 or 6 minutes, you think, you know, it's a great move, a really good ball from McGinn, a really clever run from Grealish, and a really composed finish. And it's great to see Grealish playing like a proper 10, you know, driving past the striker, getting in the box, which I'm sure Smith will be happy with. And then the second goal was a brilliant move. I mean, in Match Club, the phrase slick was thrown around quite a bit. And it was a great move out on the touchline, worked her way into the box, Grealish to McGinn, and then a little layoff. And then really Horahan couldn't miss. It was a great team goal again. And then obviously Watkins had the header, which he should have buried. And there were other chances. So Villa were looking really, really good in the first half. We could have had it home and dry by half time, really. But I think it was just they got going, and I think they saw very quickly that Fulham were there for the taking at the back. And we realised, certainly I realised watching this, that I had fears before the season that they were poorly prepared for the Premier League. And I stand by that statement. They just don't look Premier League ready at the moment.
You're talking Fulham.
Yeah, they're just not. They just lack that kind of, you know, like that sort of the spark that a newly promoted team must have, or like an organisation or a fight.
They're lacking leaders, I think.
Yeah,
especially,
they're just lacking any kind of edge. Whereas, you know, you look at someone like Leeds, or even to a certain extent, when we first came up, at least we had enthusiasm and were sort of going for it. Fulham don't even really go for it.
Yeah, Tony Khan was on about how he's been looking after, you know, looking to get centre backs in since they won the playoffs, and loads of excuses about COVID. And
yeah, I mean, their defence was bloody awful, wasn't it? I mean, the third goal sums it up. I mean, it's atrocious defending.
But I think it's going to be a bit hard for them to get these bodies in that they need before the deadline. But now they've gone three games and they've been beaten. They don't look very attractive now. They can't, you know, they can't lie their way and say, yeah, well, you know, we're going to take this league by storm, blah, 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 because people look at them and go, well, I don't know if I want to move to them because they're going to get relegated, are they? So maybe a few mercenaries will go there. But anyway, enough of them. Phil, distinctly better performance by Mr. McGinn.
Yeah, it was a really good performance by John McGinn. I mean, the word used was efficiency. His touches for the whole game were only in the 30s, yet he really looked up for it. I mean, the highlight really has been going round of a Zidane-esque sort of pirouette in the first half. But
the old double drag back.
Mm-hmm. And then in the second half, I mean, he flung himself in the tackle against Joe Bryan. I mean, it was a foul in the end, but I mean, that level of sort of desire and, you know, the speed that he ran across her to close it down, I mean, that's what's been missing from his game. I mean, some might say that's what got him injured against Southampton last year, but if he's getting back to those levels, you know, it's only a good thing for us.
But a lovely ball to Grealish for the opener.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic ball, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he could have scored himself, couldn't he? You know, I think he burst through from midfield in the second half, had a good chance. The keeper saves it well with his feet. But he's just, you can see him getting up ahead of steam now, which is can only be a good thing for the players around him.
Because last season, everybody was expecting, you know, we're struggling, you know, around winter time, and everybody's thinking, well, McGinn's coming back in March and, you know, it's going to be a game changer. But then when the lockdown happened, you're thinking, oh, well, you know, McGinn's going to have that extra time to actually get up to proper fitness and recover from the injury. So, you know, he's not being rushed back. But he was a shadow of himself in that lockdown period. So to get him to anywhere near up to where we see him will be a big bonus going forward this season. Hurrihan.
Yeah, he does what he does. One goal, one assist.
Yeah, I mean, he was, let's say, reading the game a bit better this time. I mean, the goals, you know, summed it up. It's some great interplay, but he got in the right position. And people are looking at him still as a weakness in this midfield. So you can't really complain with his performance against Fulham.
Well, he makes things happen, doesn't he? It was always the thing where you could say at him in previous years, you know, there are certain parts of his game that people would like him to have that maybe he just doesn't without the ball. But in terms of set pieces and just end product, he does deliver. And you notice, you know, the stats kind of speak for themselves when he's not in the team.
But I'm thinking more like, You've got to get this midfield to be a lot more dynamic. So you need McGinn to start playing at a you know higher level, but you need also Hourihan, because the more pressure you take off Grealish, Watkins has certainly started to do that as well.
Yeah.
But the more questions you're posing to the opposition, they're not just teaming up on, you know, 2-3 players on Grealish. They can't do that anymore because they've got other threats to deal with. And Hourihan can be one of those threats if he keeps mobile and they attack as a unit rather than just giving it to Grealish and seeing what he can do.
I'd agree with that.
Hourihan's actually the player that I would want the opposition to forget about. So if Grealish takes two or Traore takes two or Watkins takes two, you want Connor to be the one free because he knows when to shoot. He knows when to throw the cross and put it in the mixer, as we say. But you know, I think he needs to play with a bit more swagger. I mean, he's came up from the lower leagues and he is a Premier League player now. I mean, some people might not think he is, but he needs to start playing like one. And, you know, like I belong here, you know, take a bit more responsibility, have a few more shots and things. Don't always be looking for Jack. Don't always be looking for McGinn. You know, you're in their level, maybe not in some people's eyes, but you're in the same team. So start having shots, start producing.
Yeah, I think mentally he needs to be a bit, you know, even a bit more cocky, a bit more confident and cocky. And I think that added swagger would improve him as a player for sure. Because I think he's got, you know, technically he's got more in his locker. But the big thing about, you know, Grealish, if Watkins is making runs, if McGinn's being clever and Hourihan's joining in the fray, when Grealish is drawing two or three, and he's suddenly got options to play to, and those two or three he's drawing is opening up space for his teammates, rather than him just getting swamped by three and having no options to release that ball, and he just ends up in a cul-de-sac. And this is what we saw against Fulham. We were attacking as more as a wave, with Grealish drawing players up because other players were in space, so it was more effective.
And a couple of our best moments in the game were really when Grealish would pick the ball up on the touchline, spin away from the opposition player, and he's running into open ground. And that's where Grealish is at his best. And that's the Grealish we all know, we love to watch and see, because that's when he's exciting, when he's driving at a back four. And then if he's got the runners coming off him, like, you know, I thought Trezeguet put in a fantastic shift and was a more than willing runner for most of the game. I don't think he necessarily got the rewards, but I think he put in a great shift. I thought Watkins, again, he's a willing runner. He's a great outlet for Jack. And he's very clever in his distribution, you know, his hold-up play. I think he was unlucky not to get a goal again tonight. You know, he could have had a hat-trick at Bristol, which I'm sure we'll talk about shortly. Jack just, you know, the more options he has, you know, once Traore gets up to speed, I'm sure he's going to be an option. And, you know, the more tools we have at our disposal to be able to tweak how and when we attack teams. And, you know, against Bristol and you know, at Craven Cottage, you saw a Villa team for the first time in a long time that starting to look pretty deadly on the counter-attack. Yeah. And that can only be a good thing as well, because we said last season so many times that we only had one way of playing. Well, now we've got a few ways of playing. And the fact that we've sort of shored up the defence means we can now concentrate on turning defence into attack more fluidly.
Because Watkins is almost a one-man counter-attacking team, and this is the thing. I mean, there was one incident where Martinez kind of launched it up to him, and off he went against their back three, and he actually won the header, but he headed it back because there was obviously nobody beside him, and there was nobody, no Villa shirt there, so they need to get to him quicker to actually form a more constructive counter-attack. I thought Trezeguet almost had an extra yard of pace from somewhere, because he kind of tormented them. I mean, when he was running, when he switched to the left and kind of cut in, you know, he looked pretty dangerous.
He's very quick, isn't he, over the ground? He's like almost deceivingly so. You never really notice it as much in the ground when he's got the ball at his feet, but in terms of just straight line speed, he is actually very fast.
Yeah, and he was putting plenty of tackles in as well, and especially in the second half. I mean, maybe it's the benefit of having, you know, a full pre-season, and maybe the pressure that was on most of the players last season from about Christmas on, you know, it was hard for them to sort of let go. Now many of them are playing with no pressure at all, and you're seeing it's great.
Yeah, I mean, you see with Trezeguet, the rewards of, I mean, I don't know if, you know, for the listeners who follow him on social media, the videos he was putting up, as soon as we went into lockdown, he was doing extra work and fitness work. And I think he's fitter, he's stronger, he's sort of mentally sharper. I think he's probably settled in the city and he's happy here now. I'm sure he's improved with things like the language and the culture, which can only help. And as Phil said,
what,
you know,
culture?
The culture, yeah. And but you saw across the whole team as well as him that they've got that little bit of snap in their play now to kind of, You know, Trezeguet put in some great tackles. I thought Matty Cash put in 3 or 4 absolutely crunching tackles. You know, McGinn looked back to his usual, like, gritty self. I thought that all the guys along the back line, you know, were willing to put their body on the line. Louise did it numerous times. Grealish did it as well. They all look a committed team and look fitter, which can only be a good thing moving forward.
Yeah, Grealish was one of his better games in terms of getting back, because he was helping Target out, who was struggling at times there. But I think ultimately the best performance was probably, in terms of defensive matters, was Konsa. He had to man mark Mitrovic, and you thought that most people were saying it would be interesting to see Mings versus Mitrovic, but it was actually Konsa with the job. And it was an interesting test, because people, you know, say about Konsa, oh yeah, he could be like the ball playing, you know, Rio Ferdinand. But half of you is thinking, but can he play against, you know, the tough, rough, traditional number nine? And he was more of a match for Mitrovic. And that, you know, it was a pretty impressive performance and ticked a lot of boxes in terms of him being, a proper partner for Mings, and that being a solid defensive back four.
I thought the back four put in another good shift. You know, they were putting in great performances towards the end of last season. I thought the guys who've come in the cup games so far as well and replaced them, bar a couple of wobbly moments at Burton, have looked pretty good. And I think Mings and Konsa are going to take some dislodging, you know, when Engels is back from fitness, and Hawes, who is very much, I think, the backup at the minute. But those two look like a really good partnership, and they've got all the attributes that you're looking for.
You can understand why Cash converted to a fullback just based on that performance.
Yeah, he's mobile, isn't he? And he's willing, and he doesn't give up. He's got that real, as I said, that real snap in his tackle. He's got a really nasty side, which I'm really impressed by. And I think he's probably got more that he can offer going forward. I think that will come as we kind of get the games in. He did put in a couple of cracking crosses, actually. He did it in the Sheffield United game, actually. His delivery is very good when he gets into those positions. And I actually thought, as much as Target probably had quite a difficult first half, because he was clearly targeted by them, I actually think he stuck to his task really well, because they were isolating him one-on-one every time. When Grealish would push forward, it would leave Target with their guy one-on-one running at him, and they were getting balls into the box. But I thought he stuck to the task really well in the second half and actually realised he couldn't bomb on.
Phil, impressions of Cash?
What you notice about Cash is it's his positional sense. He has a really good reading of the game when the ball's coming across to the back post. We all like Freddie Gilbert, but a few times last season, he was caught out, you know, ball watching at the back post. Cash is very alive at the back post. He tucks in tight to the centre half if they're going to miss it. And you've seen one in the second half. I mean, it was hearts and mouth in a minute, because you thought he headed it into his own net, but he knew what he was doing there. He just couldn't let the ball go behind him. So he's always alive at the back post. Whenever previously, you know, I think back to that City game, De Bruyne's goal the whole way across the back line and then just tapped in at the back. Yeah. Hopefully that's not going to happen this season.
Yeah, and the boys collectively, their first clean sheet registered for the first time in their last 27 away Premier League games since the 0-0 draw with the Baggies back in January 2016.
Well, it's the first time we've won our first two league games. What was it? It's this century. The last time we did it was in 1999. Which is mad to think.
Yeah, also 2 clean sheets. Best defence, are we not? Is anybody else?
We are, Martinez is the only keeper yet to concede.
Which is completely bizarre, considering we were the second worst in terms of shipping goals last season.
Yep.
Which goes to show that whatever they did in lockdown, I mean, they spoke quite a lot, Smith did, about the reorganisation of the defence. I mean, you know, Terry had to chip in, and I'm presuming that he was in a big part of it, but you know, all these Zoom calls, etc. But they've changed the second worst defence into it's a bit of a Joss's Giants moment. Second worst defence into currently the top defence, although we'll see how it fares against Liverpool in the upcoming game. But at the end of the day, it was, when you looked at those two fixtures at the start of the season, you thought, right, if we are talking serious evolution of Aston Villa, and we saw the defence had tightened up, and you're thinking, well, you know, Watkins coming in, considering how poor we were up front in terms of legitimate striking threats, this could be a proper improvement. And the first test was to win those first two league games against two teams that we would consider winnable, and we've done that, with flying colours. So October now looks like it's going to be pretty interesting. We have Liverpool, Leeds, Leicester, Southampton, and I think after that month, we'll have a good indication of where we'll be this season.
I think the game against Fulham was probably an important game because you could undo all the good work from the Sheffield United game if you didn't beat Fulham. I mean, it's nice to get a bit of revenge on them as well. I'm petty like that. I remember the pain of the playoff final and even the FA Cup tie last year. I mean, the playoff final, I was in a charity cycle. I remember watching it in a bar. Just, you know, on the border and between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. And of course, you're sitting in the bar and what walks in but four Fulham fans, even there. And it was a bad day. So you can stick it to them.
But we're getting to a situation where Fulham look at Villa as a team they should beat. And sorry, but I don't want to live in a world where that's a reality.
That can't be a thing.
Exactly. So it's about time we started, getting back to where we used to be.
Well, it's great to see Villa, and it's, you know, whether it's Fulham or Sheffield United, whoever it may be, it's good to see Villa just starting to sort of slap teams around a little bit. Because, I mean, 3-0, I think there are a few Villa fans thinking, come on, now we've got to go and stick the knife into these and let's absolutely rip these fuckers to pieces. Steady and that's on. What I want to see Villa doing, man. I want to just stick their face in the dirt and kick them when they're down.
Anyway, sorry about that, Fulham fans. We don't like you. It's as simple as that.
You're a bunch of squares.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Anything else from that game quickly?
I thought it was a nice moment, obviously, for young Ramsey to get his Premier League debut. You know, he really impressed at Bristol, which, as I said, we'll move on to next. But great to see him, you know, involved in the matchday squad. I think he's deserved that over Lansbury. And, you know, long may his development continue this season, really.
Yeah, I mean, just that ball he delivered to Traore, the composure, and just he has a bit, and we were mentioning Conor Hourihan, but Ramsey seems to have a bit of swagger that a lot of these youth players don't come to the table with, because they're, you know, they're still trying to get that confidence and earn their spurs. But Ramsey looked, you know, you would never know that he was coming in from the academy in that game against Bristol City. I mean, we won't dwell on the game too much, but that was probably the best football we've played, I thought, up until this Fulham game. And in terms of dominating a team, we dominated that game more than the Fulham performance.
Well, we went into that one, didn't we? When you see the team sheet and you're sort of looking down there going, hang on a minute, is Almo playing centre-back? This could be interesting. And he actually had a really good game. And it was good to see sort of Gilbert back and, you know, wholesale changes. But you thought, well, Bristol have won the last four. They're going to be bang up for dumping Villa out of the cup here, and I'm sure there would have been a few pundits expecting potentially a cup shock. But Villa was so professional in the way they dispatched them. I mean, it could have been 4-5-6 very easily. I mean, some of the chances we missed in the second half, Watkins could have had a hat-trick in about 10 minutes. But three absolutely superbly crafted and executed goals, weren't they? The El Ghazi one's great work by Davis. El Ghazi can't miss, but he still puts it away. It's a great first. The Traore goal is just first class. You know, it's a great bit of play by Ramsey. Takes the ball on the half turn, spins, looks up, picks the pass really well, and then Traore's finish is sublime. And then the third goal is my favourite. What we talked about earlier with Watkins, you know, picks the ball up on the halfway line with his back to goal, turns, carries it, releases it. They're on the break, great ball in, and then he buries it. You know, it's a chance he would expect to score, but he did. And you can't argue with any of those goals. They were really well executed, really well finished, thoroughly professional performance by ultimately a second string side.
The headline thing is how we're now creating and scoring goals in open play, because
yes.
I mean, before the Fulham game, I think in the league, it 7 out of our last 9 goals are all from set pieces. So we're actually, you know, there's a bit of glitter in that, the football that we're playing now, to quote Ron Atkinson. And this is the main thing I'm kind of excited about. I want to see more link-up play and being quicker in the transition and just being smarter. And, you know, I was going to say the kind of stuff that you pay your money for, but we don't go and watch this now. But if we're going to watch these TV spectacles, you know, you want to be watching football in its finest, not just relying on set pieces and Grealish fouls.
Well, we've said numerous times, haven't we, David, on our podcasts, that you just want to see your team being proactive. You know, it doesn't always have to be sort of tick-attacker bollocks like Man City do, that, as we saw.
Tick-attacker bollocks.
It's like you don't have to overplay. I mean, you know, we've seen in the last 2 seasons that you know, the Pep way of playing can work. But now you see the Klopp way of playing that is all action, more like total football, where they can rip a team to pieces on the break, or they can pass them into submission, or they can play long and be direct if they need to. They can beat you in multiple ways. And I think that's a far more exciting prospect than just watching a team have 70-80% of the possession and knock it around.
Also, we're, you know, across the cup and league games so far, our centre backs are popping up and scoring as well, which is vital.
Absolutely.
Most good teams have everybody chips in and centre-backs always come in. And we needed that threat. And Mings, you know, he should be scoring more goals. I mean, he should be getting like 5 or 6 a season.
Yeah, it was a well-timed run and everything. He just got enough of a contact in the ball to put it past the film keeper, which whatever he was doing.
I think Mings and Konza's performances, I think, will be improved as well by having, you know, Martinez behind him, because they'll feel confident now with the guy between the posts.
Although you say that, let's go back to the Fulham game and the VAR moment, which saved us. You could argue, I mean, Mings goes for a ball's played in, Mings goes for it, and he misjudges it, and Martinez is kind of surprised the ball comes to him, because he's thinking that Mings has got this. That's why he spills it. You could argue that he should have caught that anyway, but you can understand why he spilled it, because it was a bit of an element of surprise there. I think he kind of switched off, not as in switching off, but, you know, he's kind of relaxing, thinking that's Mings's ball. And then he spills it, comes back, it's in the back of the net. But in the lead up to that, Konza is fouled by Mitrovic, and this is VAR working well, I think, where the VAR guy's checking it and you can see the lead up to the play, and it didn't take that long, did it? It wasn't like crazy.
It wasn't too bad, to be fair.
But this is where it comes in well, because yes, Konza may have got to that ball before the guy who's put it in the net, but no complaints with it. I mean, we've seen some crazy VAR shit. I mean, some of the games before the Villa game against Fulham, where, you know, the game carries on for 3 minutes and then it's pulled back. It's, you know, it's still ridiculous in its execution, but at least in that example, and it's, you know, it spared Martinez blushes big time, because we'll now forget about that mistake, because it didn't actually lead to anything. But at least VAR was actually doing its job there.
And he made amends with an absolutely brilliant save from, it was Bryant, wasn't it, later in the game, and he tips it onto the crossbar.
Yeah, and he's, you know, his distribution is very good as well, yeah, so far. Right, let's wrap up with another episode of Underrated or Overrated. Right, this is the section where we look back in recent history to reevaluate a couple of ex-Villa players and see if our memories have warped over the years, or if the mythology has twisted what we thought of them at the time. The first one up, I think we'll go with Mr. Cox on this one. Neil Cox, bit of a utility player, slotted in at right back. Why did we get him, Mr. Bud?
Well, was this a Joe Venglos signing? I think it was about 400,000 from Scunthorpe, with the nice added bonus that we
the reason why we bought him, because we needed to shift 2,000 blue, you know, sky blue seats
that Doug Ellis had spare,
and it's like, oh, hang on a minute, Scunthorpe, they play in the same colours,
yeah. And apparently they're still there today. Is it Glanford Park they play? I think it's Glanford Park.
Yeah. Sunny Scunny. Being from Lincoln, they're one of our rivals.
Go to the seaside and never see the sea.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was brought in as a kind of, as you said, a utility player. You know, he could play as centre back or a right back, which was where he predominantly played for Villa. He could also play in sort of midfield if they needed him to. And he was even found in goal a couple of times for Villa, apparently. Well, Nigel Spink went off injured again in the 93-94 season, and Villa had, this was back when it was just three subs, and I believe
I remember him once, but I didn't know it was twice.
And I think he came off the bench because we didn't take a goalkeeper sub that game for whatever reason. So Cox played in goal. I think we got battered, you know, 3-4-1 that day. But you know, he could do multiple things. I'm sure that was probably his, you know, his versatility might have been his downfall later on. But yeah, he was brought in as a, it was like a bit, not a wonder kid, but he was a really promising, very young player at, you know, a low division club, a little bit in the same mould, I'd imagine, as like when we bought James Bree or someone cut from that kind of mould.
But he was, I mean, I remember him as, you got to the stage where he did a job. It wasn't as if, he's one of your squad players. I don't think he ever elevated above that. But for example, you know, when he came on in the cup final, but when... you know, Staunton was, I mean, he went into that game with an injury, Steve Staunton. So when he eventually came off, it's not as if suddenly, you know, you're kind of panicking that much. I mean, he did all right, actually, Cox against United.
Well, it was backs to the wall, wasn't it, when he came on?
Yeah.
Bit of a Courtney Hawes when he came on in the playoff final, same sort of
scenario. Yeah, very similar, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, how many games did he play for Villa? I can't remember.
About 50, and scored a couple of goals.
And he, of course, he went to, I think he got, Brian Robson tapped him up when we played United, and because Brian Robson went on to be a Middlesbrough manager, and he when he took that job, he dropped Cox a line, and Neil Cox joined Middlesbrough before it became fashionable for Villa players to join Middlesbrough. So he is the godfather of Villaborough phenomena.
Well, he was Borough's first million-pound player, believe it or not. He went there because he was a massive Man United fan and obviously wanted to work with Brian Robson.
Was he a million? Did we sell him for a million?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So doubled our money on him.
Yeah, it's a good bit of business.
Any outstanding memories of Mr. Cox?
My outstanding memory of him, other than him being... The sticker I had most of in my Panini album, I had about 100 Neil Coxes. He scored against us for Bolton whenever we had a very good team in 98. He had a shot, hit the post, hit Bosnich in the back of the head and went in. That was when
it was a volley, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, somehow beat us at home with one of our best ever teams. But yeah, that was the memory I have him. All those stickers are probably somewhere still.
I remember he scored against Everton in the year we were chasing down United for the first Premier League title, and he sort of somehow managed to find himself on the edge of the penalty area, cut inside and smacked one in the bottom corner. That was a really good goal. And then I remember him scoring a consolation at Old Trafford the following season. I think we were 3-0 down at the time, and he got the consolation in that one. But not a huge amount of memories. He was a player I didn't see a lot of, just because it was quite early on in my Villa supporting life.
Your Villa supporting career. I mean, just to bring Cox to a close, I mean, last seen, he's actually the manager of Scunthorpe United. So this story actually turns full circle. So he's now managing at a club where his transfer actually got them 2,000 sky blue seats, which is a kind of bizarre... not bizarre, it's quite a nice ending to the tale, actually. I'd almost give him underrated just for that.
Well, that's a great practical piece of business, isn't it? No, that's a real lasting legacy. You know, those plastic seats are non-biodegradable. They're going to last a heck of a lot longer than an overpaid footballer.
I mean, he's got a cause to get that stand named after him since 2000, the seats
the Neil
are
Cox,
all down.
The Neil Cox seats stand.
Yeah. Right, anyway, underrated or overrated, Neil Cox? Phil's going first.
Yeah, I'm going to go underrated because, you know, I can't think of anything really he did wrong when he played for us. And we did manage to sell him for a profit as well. So I have no complaints.
Yeah, I think that. I think the fact that when he arrived at Villa, and especially when Big Ron came in, we had such a bloody big squad, and then he brought in Earl Barrett, that he slipped down the pecking order, not really through any fault of his own. He just wasn't given the opportunities to shine. But, you know, he was an England under-21 international, and he went on and had a sort of solid, if not spectacular, career. The fact that we made, you know, we doubled our money on him would be considered a really good piece of business.
We've spoken about this before. You look at that 1994 team that went to the final and beat Manchester United, because the fact that Neil Cox and Graham Fenton picked up Cup winners' medals shows you that outside that kind of first 11, I know Fenton started that game, but, you know, let's say you wouldn't consider him for that 93-94 team as one of the first 11. But the fact that those two players that most Villa supporters would have kind of forgotten as real entities picked up a winners' medal says something, A, about that team just being a good first 11. Because we look at now our squad, we've got all these, you know, players that are squad filler, really. And arguably, Fenton and Cox aren't as good as them.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, with the final, when you look at the, you know, who was on the bench for that game, and you think that you had Neil Cox on the bench over guys like Dwight York and Gary Parker and people like that, you know, who didn't even make the squad for that game. It shows that Atkinson and Venglos, they must have really sort of rated his versatility. And at that point in the days of three subs, you probably needed versatile subs who could play in a number of positions. So actually, it's probably why he found himself on the bench a lot, because he was a good option to have around.
The Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
Right, I'll go underrated for that as well, because there's no mud on him. There's no shit on him. So the manager of Scunthorpe United is underrated. Right then, something a bit more controversial. Mr. Richard Dunn, a defender that I wasn't a big fan of before we got him, because he was just too mistake prone, especially when it came down to own goals. So why did we buy him?
We had to buy him because Martin Larsson got Martin Larsson injured. Surprise, surprise. And
surely not.
And then Curtis Davis, who at the time was a competent centre-back, he was injured as well. So Martin O'Neill, being ever the future planner, was left with just Carlos Cuellar as a fit centre-back, with about a couple of days left of the transfer window. So somehow he managed to sign James Collins and Richard Dunn on the same day.
Because he did really go for basically rebuilding the back line, didn't he?
Yeah.
It was a change in era.
If only would have had maybe a young centre-back like Gary Cahill or something that's still around that we could have slotted in, but no.
Who?
Yes, someone who knew the club really well and had a really bright prospect, if only.
Yeah.
Dunn was, what's the word for Richard Dunn? I mean, it was a bit like, in some respects, like the David James signing, where you thought, oh God, what are we signing him for? He's, you know, he's calamity, and Richard Dunn was a calamity also in his position, but then put in a good, you know, had a good season, but more than one season, but performed well. And before he made any mistakes or scored any own goals, you know, the kind of tropes that people would identify him with, he actually was pretty decent and kind of won a many fan over.
Yeah, that first season he was great, wasn't he? Was it 09-10 he made the Premier League team of the season that year?
Yeah.
And he was just like a battering ram at set pieces as well. Him and Collins were very good from set pieces. Obviously, we had, you know, the likes of Young and Downing, etc., delivering high quality crosses in at that point in time. But in terms of a defender, you know, he played in the infamous Carling Cup final where we lost to Man U, and, you know, he got outpaced by a Michael Owen with one hamstring. And I just remember Dunn as having the turning circle of a ship.
What a Titanic.
Yeah, he was just, you know, he's a good, I suppose you'd class him as a typically old-fashioned British defender, you know, that kind of real...
Well, he might look more like Sunday League when you looked at him.
Yeah, he wasn't exactly lean and mean, was he, let's be honest. But, he'd had a pretty good international career. The Man City fans kind of... He was almost like a bit of a cult hero. He was in the ballpark of like a Sean Gota or something up there, where he wasn't necessarily the best player, but they seemed to have an affinity with him for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, he was unlucky to sort of be shown the door at City, because that was the time when City had just got taken over and they were looking to be brand Man City around the world. And their chief executive at the time, Gary Cook, said, "China and India are gagging for football content, and we're going to tell them that City is the content. We need a superstar. Richard Dunn just doesn't roll off the tongue in Beijing." So he was...
Would that have been around when they bought like Robinho and these sorts of players? It was when they were buying the first wave of, you know, it wasn't quite the superstars. Then wasn't it? They hadn't been bought by the Sheikh, wasn't it? That Shinawatra or whatever his name was.
Yeah.
It was when they had the Chinese owner, wasn't it? Under Sven.
Mm-hmm. They were probably wanting to protect their investments. They didn't want Richard Dunn tackling anywhere near Rubinho in training.
Yeah, I mean, he still holds the Premier League record, doesn't he, for the most amount of times he's being sent off, and also holds the Premier League record for own goals, which is fantastic.
Yeah, which I mean makes him a cult hero in my book.
He's an own goals and gaffes wet dream.
I mean, he was an own goal specialist. That probably doesn't, you know, that's Premier League goals. Probably another 25 in cups as well.
He just had that sort of clumsy, not particularly subtle, I think would be the way to put it. He was very much a crash bang wallop defender who put his head on the line and all that sort of stuff. But
he on his day could stop anybody. I mean, he could be really immense. This was the thing. But you've got, like, you know, you look at Paul McGrath, and it's a different kettle of fish. But there is that thing where it's you know, when I was saying cult hero, but Paul McGrath didn't have the weaknesses. I mean, apart from, you know, he obviously had a problem with alcohol, and Dunn, you know, he liked to drink as well. I mean, Paul McGrath, you wouldn't know he's an alcoholic necessarily watching him, but Richard Dunn, it was like guaranteed, I think. But that was part of the charm of him. It was like he couldn't be arsed. And
yeah, he was a very frustrating figure, because he had, you know, a colossus performance on him every now and again. There was a famous game he played for Ireland against Russia where even McGrath said it was the best performance he'd ever seen from a centre-back.
Yeah.
So that was in him. It's just consistency didn't happen for him.
I think that might come with maybe professionalism off the pitch, in terms of he's still in that era where they like to, you know, knock a few beers back. But if he was I'm not saying this is a good thing, but like a robot and doing the whole kind of professional athlete approach, that might have paid off on the pitch, would be one explanation I would offer up. But ultimately it was kind of drinking discipline issues that started his downfall at Villa, was it not?
Apparently so, yeah. Him and Collins got into trouble, didn't they? And I know when obviously O'Neill left, he didn't have the best relationship with Houllier, to say the least. I know Richard Dunn pretty much despised Houllier, didn't he? Because I think Dunn was playing in that game in, I believe it was Paris, when Henri scored the handball goal that knocked Ireland out of the World Cup qualifying. And Houllier must have obviously seen him after the game with a smug smile, and then he just hated him ever since, apparently. And he seemed to hold a real grudge over that incident with Houllier.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why. And then obviously there was a couple of incidents with him and Collins getting into a bit of trouble together for their off-field antics, and
there was other things that never made the press. I mean, for example, remember under McLeish where we were playing Bolton at home.
Oh, that was an awful night.
Yeah,
when it turned,
that got really toxic, didn't it, that night?
But it was an important game. It was like one we had to win, and we went 1-0 up, and then within a blink of an eye, we were 2-1 down, and that's when the halt turned against him. Well, as most listeners will know, that there's a 48-hour kind of curfew on drinking before games, and I got a tip-off from somebody who was actually working the event at Richard Dunn's house in his back garden, that allegedly his girlfriend, wife at the time, I can't remember if it's wife or it was her 30th, and I got a tip off, and this was within the curfew of like 48 hours, that say him and a few Villa players who were also invited were knocking back a few brewskis at that. And when you consider how important that game against Bolton was, you can kind of see how, in Alex McLeish's position, when it's going against you, it's going against you. And, you know, even your players aren't, you know, taking it seriously. And which, as a supporter, you got to be a bit pissed off at, because actually it's the fate of the club that they're also pissing on as well, and getting paid very handsomely to do it. So Dunn, where is he now?
He's living in Monte Carlo with his family.
Is he?
Very nice.
Yeah.
He's just gone up in my estimation of him.
But he does do a regular column for the Irish Independent. So he's dipping his toe in punditry.
I remember he buggered off to QPR, did he not? And
he finished his career there, didn't they? I think
that was when QPR were throwing money at anybody, weren't they?
But they were just, this is the start of them going out of business, basically, wasn't it? When they had was it Basingua on Megabucks and Adel Taarabt and all these people that
Samba as well?
Yeah, Harry Redknapp wanted to buy and just went ballistic with this tiny little club.
Yeah, if he goes for a jog, he might get a call from Fulham before the end of the week.
All right. Anyway, so make sure you subscribe to the Irish Independent to read Richard Dunn's beautiful prose. I think we're giving him a hard time here. When he was at the club, he was actually performing better than my expectations. I mean, I would have never bought him in the first place, but on his day, he was a very good centre-back. It's just that you couldn't trust him.
And his fitness record went down the pan, didn't it, towards the end of his Villa career, unfortunately, as he got older.
Yeah. Well, all these things relate, you know, he's off yeah. the field, indulgences, etc. You know, it never helps the on the field stuff and the general fitness. So Richard Dunn at Villa, it's a tough one because he actually did all right under O'Neill, I thought.
That first, if you did it just off the 09-10 season, you'd say it was great. But then, you know, how it career declined at Villa sort of sours it somewhat.
Yeah.
Underrated or overrated?
Overrated, fuck it.
Yeah, I'm going to go overrated as well, because if you have the potential in you to put in some of the one-off performances that he did and you don't carry it through to that level, then no, yeah, I'm going overrated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you're making the team of the season in your first year, and as we've said, putting in the performances we did and being a centre-back that is, you know, part of a good unit there that's pushing to try and be in the top four, and then it to suddenly go down and down and down, and I just think something's lacking.
Pull the trigger.
Yeah, I'm going to go overrated.
Right, there you go. Richard Dunn, overrated at Villa. Right, it's time to move on. We're now, as we mentioned earlier on in the show, the season's starting to warm up a little. It's because we had that belated start. It doesn't feel like we're kind of rocking and rolling just yet. But now the games start to come thick and fast. And I'm looking forward to Liverpool Leeds. I think that's where the fire starts to burn. This season will certainly warm up from there. Right, please do let us know what you think of the show. Generally, I mean, we're very tired, I must admit, recording this one. But please do on social media leave your comments or, you know, join in on any of the talking points that we said. And don't forget to retweet it if you see it on Twitter to help get the word out and mention it to your like-minded buddies who may be stuck in isolation due to this Villa Park depriving pandemic. You can follow the show on all good podcast apps, and especially on Apple, Spotify. It's on Amazon Music as well. And don't forget, the best way to help the My Old Man Said podcast is to become a patron, and also to get closer to the show, do join us in Match Club as well. Right, thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me at this midnight hour as per usual, and until next time, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport, powered by fans.